Some observers call it another headache for the U.S., referring to a controversial visit by the U.S. House of Speaker to Taiwan. The Chinese U.S. ambassador has warned the visit could go as far as undermining Beijing-Washington's relationship. China had already warned it won't sit idle by, and the U.S. would have to pay the price for the visit. Nancy Pelosi has been on an East Asian tour, and her plane just landed in Taipei. Ironically, the visit is not backed by the White House. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our panelists in this episode and get down to business. Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khani, joining us from Detroit. Also with us is journalist and author Daniel Lazar. He's in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Great to see you, gentlemen. Let me start with Saeed Khan. Given stark warnings by China against this visit, the U.S. did go ahead with the plan. And as you know, Pelosi is visiting Taipei. And we hear that Chinese are flying and crossing the Taiwan Strait. Now, what goal is the U.S. pursuing by way of such a visit?
I think there's two goals that are really at work here. One is for the international audience, for the United States to appear as though it is strong, that it is pushing back on what is now certainly the emerging dominant superpower in the world, China. And the other is really looking at it in a domestic context. After all, this is the midterm elections year. And by showing the Democrats and by extension, President Biden, although as you said, this trip is not officially sanctioned by the White House, but it would be highly unlikely that Speaker Pelosi would go without some kind of coordination or acknowledgement. After all, she is in a plane that says United States of America. I mean, she was going in an official plane from the U.S. Air Force. So it indicates that there is some effort to burnish the Democratic Party when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to trying to move the needle even slightly in what is going to be a very contentious and a very tight election this November.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, there is also a division among U.S. authorities about this visit. The White House does not favor it. And President Joe Biden has even said that the military believes, I'm quoting, the visit is not a good idea right now. So why did Pelosi decide to go to Taiwan? I mean, who's calling the shots as far as the U.S. foreign policy is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, I must disagree with your previous speaker. I think the image that's being projected is of one of gross incompetence and disarray. I mean, you have the Speaker of the House, an 82-year-old woman, essentially making foreign policy on her own, while the Biden administration sort of stands aside and sort of shrugs. And not only is she making foreign policy, but she is making foreign policy in an extraordinarily dangerous way. Now, I think that this is not going to enhance U.S. standing around the globe. I think quite the contrary, it'll grossly undermine it. It'll show that the American leadership is incompetent, unreliable, immature, flighty, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it'll do the U.S. no good. It'll do it much harm. And I expect that Biden will be paying more and more of a price as things go on. And we haven't even seen yet what the full Chinese retaliation looks like.
Saeed, as you may know, Washington claims that it is adhering to this so-called One China policy, but it still provides weaponry and military hardware to Taiwan. How come? I mean, is it justifiable?
Right. First of all, I don't disagree at all with Mr. Lazar. The question posed to me was, what do I think is behind it? But the reality as to what would be the results are, I think, incredibly irresponsible for why Pelosi is in Taiwan. Segueing into your question regarding American policy, it's rather strange, isn't it, that the U.S. State Department has on its own website acknowledgement that it does not have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but it has what it calls a, quote, robust unofficial relationship, one that seems to then extend to selling Taiwan a tremendous amount of weaponry, to be a thorn in the side of China, to be arguably as provocative with China in its presence with Taiwan as the Soviet Union was with Cuba during the 1960s. The only difference, of course, is that nuclear weapons are not being stationed in Cuba. But we are certainly in China's neighborhood and doing so in a provocative way. And now at a time when China can actually go ahead and flex its muscles in a much more robust way. And we're seeing that this is happening right now. You stated that the South China Sea airspace was closed by China. And also the announcement of 4 days of military exercises in the area. Including the stationing of a whole lot of Chinese weaponry on the shores facing Taiwan. Any kind of live ammunition that is going to be used is going to be heard in Taiwan, and it's going to certainly send a message. This is just a bad idea all around.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, same question for you, because China is complaining all the time that the U.S. is ignoring and disrespecting this One China policy, but the U.S. is, we are sticking to it. At the same time, they're selling weaponry to Taiwan.
Yes, the U.S. is in the habit of saying one thing and doing the opposite. I mean, it's escalating things in the South China Sea and Taiwan, yet it insists in the same breath that it's not really escalating at all. In the Ukraine, it expanded NATO, steadily farther eastward, but then insisted that that it was not threatening Russia at all. Russia had no cause to be alarmed. There was nothing to worry about at all. So the U.S. has a way of completely belying its own statements, and that's what's going on here. I mean, clearly, the One China policy is a difficult artificial policy, which at some point was going to fall apart, and the U.S. has an unofficially robust relationship with Taiwan, so it's officially unofficial, but the point is, I mean, Biden clearly is chafing at the bit. He's moving to overthrow the One China policy, but he's afraid to say so. So as a result, his policies look more and more incoherent, and no one knows where they're going. And China is getting seriously alarmed. It feels that a military confrontation is inevitable, so it's gearing up.
Saeed, there are some analysts who argue that this is part of the U.S. strategy to keep Russia stuck in the Ukraine war, and Daniel just mentioned Ukraine, and also China busy with Taiwan. Do you share the same view?
I'm really not sure. I mean, after all, those are two different scenarios. Keeping Russia bogged down in Ukraine at the expense of the Ukraine is rather cynical, but it wouldn't be the first time that the United States operates its foreign policy in such cynicism. Regarding Taiwan, I agree with Daniel that here this idea of almost taking a page out of Sun Tzu's Art of War, that if your enemy is annoyed, go ahead and annoy him more. And it seems as though this is just, again, a provocation more than really moving the needle one way or the other. After all, I cannot recall any serious presidential candidate going back several decades who has even broached the idea of announcing that they would recognize Taiwan and its independence. So clearly there is a line in the sand that no one seems willing to go ahead and cross. But the idea then of keeping China in a state of alarm in its own backyard, certainly if any foreign power were to enter the United States' stated zone of influence, whether it's through the good neighbor policy or the former Monroe Doctrine, there would be alarmism over here. It doesn't behoove the United States to treat a very important and a very large power, both economically and militarily, in this way, because the chances of a slip-up are just simply too large.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, how do you look at this? Has the U.S. adopted this, what is called as a dual containment policy with China and Russia to try and exhaust the two powers, you know, and keep them in quagmires overseas?
I think that's sort of expecting too much of the U.S. I mean, I think, first of all, the war in the Ukraine is not going at all well from a U.S. perspective. The Russian war machine is grinding on. There are signs of instability and disarray in Kiev, indications that things are not going at all well for the Zelensky government, and the global economy is in real trouble. So the American military policy has backfired. The sanctions have backfired. So I'm not really sure the U.S. knows what to do. And in this case, in Taiwan, it just appears to me that Biden, through sheer incompetence and neglect, has allowed himself to be maneuvered into a very dangerous situation by hotheads in his own party. And that is, you know, he's lost control, he's lost leadership, and that is a very bad position to allow yourself to fall into. So I don't see the U.S. pursuing any kind of consistent policy. I see it pursuing a consistently incompetent policy.
Mm-hmm. And Syed, is this all aimed at creating a world in which the U.S. Is the sole superpower so that it could dictate its policies to other countries?
I think even the United States now is not so deluded into thinking that it could bring back unipolarity and become the sole superpower that it was in the aftermath of the Cold War in the early 1990s. Although certainly we do see examples where it has made that attempt with the expansion, as Daniel said, of NATO further and further encroaching into Eastern Europe and then former Soviet republics throughout the area, including the Baltic states, and certainly a push toward including the Ukraine into that. But I think that it shows a certain kind of clumsy acknowledgement that the United States is no longer the sole superpower, and where it can, it will then create diversions, it will create distractions, and it'll create these kinds of provocations, whether to distract the superpowers or hopefully not, create then an escalation. Because we have to ask ourselves a question, who would benefit with this kind of escalation in both rhetoric and then, as we see with China, military mobilization? Certainly the U.S. defense industry, I'm sure, must be salivating at the very idea that they can then justify selling more weapons, not only to the U.S. and increase its already rather bloated defense budget, but also to sell weapons to many of the regional entities, including Taiwan, as well as Australia, and Japan, those two countries being, with India, part of the so-called strategic quad. Whether those countries want to then accept the gambit of America's incompetence and what would be seen as aggression in the area remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, do you agree with Syed?
I do, actually, but I would just add that in order to sell weapons and enlist the support of the quad, the U.S. has got to maintain a very tough posture. It has got to show that it is the boss, and that is what is so dangerous, because essentially China is determined to show the chain, the same. So you have two countries in an increasingly confrontational mode, and we don't know what the result will be, but there's every reason to fear that things could and will get out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of this confrontational mode site, I was just trying to get to that. The U.S. policy and the strategy overseas, are they not pushing countries like China and also Russia to try and to have to actually adopt this confrontational mode vis-a-vis the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it depends on, again, whether they're going to go ahead and accept what the United States puts on the table and then try to escalate it. Right now, we see that the United States was trying to isolate Russia into just one arena, which was the Ukraine. Unfortunately, here in the United States, there has been an almost steady drumbeat of trying to bring in the Taiwan situation and equate it with the Ukraine. Those two things had nothing in common. The status quo regarding China and Taiwan had been there for 50 years. It had not been an invasion. The United States itself acknowledges the sovereignty the lack of independence and sovereignty of Taiwan with the one China policy. And yet, as Daniel aptly said, there are people who are agents provocateurs within the Democratic Party. Certainly the Republican Party is always up for a good war to then try to go ahead and rope China in. And I would say that it also then shows the weakness that the United States has of trying to leverage any kind of economic activity to weaken China. So right now we're dealing with some dangerous rhetoric and the possibility of a further military contextualization of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, U.S. policies do not seem to have been able to weaken other powers like China and Russia, don't they? The two are just getting closer to each other every day. They're even forming alliances with other nations, you know, pitching in. So what repercussions could it entail for the U.S.?
Well, I think the problem is that U.S. power is rapidly fading, and it's fading in a variety of ways. I mean, still its military clout is still considerable. Its economic clout is immense. There's no doubt about that. I don't want to exaggerate. But the U.S. simply doesn't have the profile it had during the golden age of 1991 to 2003. Joe Biden came into office, declaring America is back, and he's been trying to restore some of that lost glory. But I think in so doing, he's pushing things too far, and he is essentially getting into serious trouble in the Ukraine and now apparently in the Western Pacific. So I don't know where this is going to lead, but I see great instability in Washington. I see a Biden administration that really doesn't know what it's doing. I see a president who is extremely old and is personally not in control, and I see a Democratic Party which is gripped with panic as to what will happen in the upcoming midterm elections.
Now, Syed, regarding this Pelosi visit to Taiwan, Russia has come out and announced that the way China has reacted to this is absolutely justifiable, and it's also given its full support to Beijing. So how significant could this be?
I think what this shows and it affirms is the relationship that Moscow and Beijing now have. If anything, they feel emboldened to be the so-called anti-heroes compared to the West. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think it's also important to recognize that it doesn't seem as though too much of the West is really speaking out about this right now as far as endorsing what Speaker Pelosi is doing. There doesn't seem to be an awful lot of official statements coming out of Western capitals to demonstrate that they are in support of what the United States posture is, because they, of course, have very close ties with China, and they have to prioritize those, whether they're economic or for those countries in the Western Pacific, recognizing their own security needs and what might be seen as a rather mercurial relationship that the United States has. After all, when it comes to being able to depend upon or rely upon American consistency of policy, that is something that's been rather elusive over the last at least 20 years in many different arenas around the world, and people have been paying attention to that. On top of that, I think that the kinds of decision-making when it comes to American security interests have been woefully irresponsible. The Quad, for example, has three countries, one of which is effectively unable to really push back because of its proximity to China. I'm speaking of Japan. Australia just simply likes to go along for the ride with the United States. But you also have India, and India has proven to be militarily, strategically very weak when it comes to confronting China, as we saw last year with two border clashes, relatively minor, but ones that were certainly defeats for the Indian Army. But India also, it seems, despite the kind of warming of relations and the wooing by the Biden administration and other Western countries as well, has gravitated toward both Russia and, interestingly and ironically enough, even to China when it comes to addressing energy needs and breaching the sanctions that have been placed against both Russia and China. Right. So if that's really the case about America trying to project its power, it probably needs to use a different playbook.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, you know about warnings that China has been giving since maybe a week or so before this Pelosi visit to Taiwan. It said that U.S. is playing with fire. It warned against it and said that they should pay the price for this. And they announced, you know, those targeted operations, you know, some military exercises. Could it go further beyond this? Could it translate into full-fledged war?
I think there really is no reason to think otherwise. I mean, what we've seen is a steady and now intensifying escalation. So it seems to be heading in only one direction, and that is towards some kind of confrontation. I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was possible a few years ago, but now it seems to be unavoidable. And for the U.S., the dilemma is that a war in China's backyard is one it really can't possibly win. The New York Times, for example, pointed out not long ago that the U.S. has two air bases within 500 miles of Taipei. China has 39. That's a woeful imbalance. And the Pentagon has staged 18 war games designed to simulate a China-U.S. showdown in the Western Pacific. And in every single one of them, the U.S. has lost. So the U.S. is facing real problems.
Okay. And Saeed, let's have your opinion on the possibility of war.
I think that, as Daniel said, it's more relative speaking that the chances are, unfortunately, greater now than they were earlier in the last few years. My concern is actually a war beginning out of a some kind of a reckless move, some kind of an accident, for example, one ship hitting another ship in the South China Sea could then be the provocation that lights the tinderbox. It would be nice to see cooler heads prevail, but it seems that right now, if one takes a look at the rhetoric, both coming out of Beijing as well as out of Washington, there seems to be a kind of amping up, almost an appetite for the prospect of war, hopefully not the inevitability of one.
Mm-hmm. And to Daniel, one last question, because Pelosi said that my visit shows our commitment to Taiwan. Is it really what the U.S. is trying to do, or trying to weaken China's influence, or what?
As I said, the America's actions are really inexplicable. The very fact that Pelosi is saying one thing and Biden saying another is very strange and very off-putting. The world doesn't like it. So it's not clear what the U.S. is doing. The U.S., but it is behaving more aggressively. There is a big reservoir of support for Taiwan in Washington. And it seems as if the U.S. is gravitating towards some kind of repudiation of the one China policy. But if that happens, if that's correct, and if that happens, the results will be titanic.
Okay, thank you so much for your contribution. Saeed Khan in Detroit and Daniel Lazar in New York. And thank you. I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the lifestyle of Imam Hussein. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. I would like to send you my sincere condolences for the arrival of the month of Muharram and for the martyrdom anniversary of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. Now today, as we're talking about the lifestyle of Al-Imam Hussein, I would like to portray a few things of how he came to stand against the oppression that was happening during his time. The Holy Imam sallallahu alayhi wasallam saw that he was the only one responsible in the view of Allah, and it was solely his responsibility to bring about a revolution. At the time, there were so many oppressions happening. The tyrant rulers had done so much bad into the society that it was so difficult for anyone else to come and correct what had happened to the life of the people at the time. Now, and if Imam Hussein wouldn't have taken any steps against the wrong being continued by the ruling tyrants, who else could do that? So hence, Imam Hussein decided to express his aims that he wanted to remove the oppressions and the mischief and revive the enjoining of good and restraining from evil so that he could lead the people to truth and justice. All these aims of the Holy Imam were mentioned in his illuminated summons that he issued to the army forces comprised of Hur and soldiers of Ibn Ziyad. Imam Hussein is reported to be saying so many speeches that were aiming at making sure that people realize that now we are living in bad times of the tyrant rulers. The tyrant rulers are destroying our society. We need to stand against this. We need to take a stand against this particular time of period when we are being oppressed. The book of Allah is being stand against, and people are not believing in the words of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. So the work of Imam Hussein was to stand against the oppression, was to stand against the mischief that was happening at the period, and to say no to the tyrant rulers.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio, and we are talking about the lifestyle of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. How did Imam Al-Hussein get into the situation of fighting against the oppression at the time? It is said from his speech, one of his speeches, when he was saying one of his speeches to his companions, Imam Hussein said, "O people, the Messenger of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, one who sees a tyrant ruler making the unlawful of Allah as lawful and ignoring the commands of Allah and opposing the practice of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, committing before the very eyes of the people sins and transgressions, and he does not object to that, he does not object against him by words or action, it becomes incumbent on Allah to make him enter the same place that the very tyrant shall go in hell." Imam Hussein continued by saying, "All of them have obeyed the shaitan, and they have become distant from the obedience of the beneficent. They have made corruption open and general. They have trespassed the limits and have took over public property in their sole control, and have made the unlawful things lawful and the lawful things unlawful." These words of Imam Hussein's were expressing that people need to stand against the oppression, people need to stand against the unlawful tyrants, the bad tyrants at the time. They need to say no to them, because by keeping quiet on this, it will make you be like them. It will make you go have the same reward as they have. If they'll go to hell, we will go to hell. Imam Hussein is trying to tell his people, his companions, that you will go to hell if they will go to hell just because you didn't say anything. You didn't stand against the unlawful acts. It's upon us, it's upon every Muslim to stand against any unlawful acts that he's saying in his life, as the companions of Imam Hussein studied and learned from Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you so much for listening. We'll meet you in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en-islam-page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence fills the air. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed in the seventh edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
Shireen was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the U.S. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shireen Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
The Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women, who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
Organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee, the event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights, to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and their rights are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Two days after several explosions rocked the northern neighborhood of Wazir Akbar Khan in the Afghan capital Kabul, the U.S. claims the CIA successfully targeted a safe house there, killing al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. The pressure is again on people, as unfortunately, it has become very common to wake up to the sound of explosions every morning.
It was 6 o'clock in the morning when a strong explosion shocked us. We were working here and saw the smoke. I don't know the cause of the blast, but Taliban did not let anyone get close to the area.
At first, the Taliban claimed that the explosions were caused by blind rockets. Now that the drone strike has been confirmed, the Taliban condemn it and consider it a violation of Afghan sovereignty and the Doha Agreement signed between them and the U.S. They also stressed that the targeted house was empty during the raid and that there were no casualties.
As it is about sovereignty of Afghanistan, no country has the right to attack Afghanistan with manned or unmanned planes. The statements that the U.S. is making on al-Zawahiri are just claims. The U.S. does what it wants by force.
The recent airstrike in Kabul has now stoked fears among people. They are scared that such incidents might happen more and more frequently, as they witnessed 10 members of a family, including 6 children, were targeted a year ago in a drone strike before the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The Afghan people are most shocked by what happened. They say their land has become a hotspot for settling international accounts they have nothing to do with. But, as always, they have to bear the brunt of such incidents. Abdullah Amirzadeh from Kabul.
Lebanon's leaders have once more met with the U.S. Energy Envoy, who is in Beirut for talks. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati, and Parliament Speaker Nabih Haberi have reportedly given the envoy a unified Lebanese proposal, which the envoy will be taking to the Israeli side for a response. Amos Hochstein told reporters after the meeting that he was optimistic that a demarcation agreement will be reached in the coming weeks.
I remain optimistic that we can make continuous progress as we have over the last several weeks, and I look forward to coming back to the region and being able to make the final arrangement.
This comes one day after Hezbollah's resistance movement released footage of gas barges in the Quraysh field, their coordinates and a surface-to-sea missile, warning the Israelis that wasting time is not beneficial.
The video released by the resistance will strengthen Lebanon's position as a party in the talks and will give the three leaders a new bargaining chip, just like the Hezbollah drones help move the talks forward and bring Hochstein back to Lebanon. The coming hours will be decisive, and we will see realistic steps and will most probably go back to indirect talks in Naghoura, but we have very little time.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also repeated that all Hezbollah wants in this file is to help Lebanon and give the state elements of strength in the negotiations.
If we cannot drill and take out our wealth, so nobody else will do. And we are waiting until we see if Hochstein has in his trip to Lebanon any solution to lift off all the sanctions against Lebanon.
Said Nasrallah said in light of the outcome, Hezbollah will decide how to act in the coming period. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has stressed that he will not be lenient when it comes to Lebanon's right to its natural resources. He also said he will no longer accept that Lebanon be the subject of discrimination as it has in the past. The statement is backed by what seems to be a new strategy by the resistance, which could give Lebanon the upper hand in the maritime talks. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Prince Charles, Britain's heir to the throne, in yet more hot water for accepting questionable donations to his charitable fund, this time from a family whose name brings back horrifying memories. Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, wealthy construction magnates and half-brothers of the dead Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, reportedly donated $1.7 million to a charitable fund that the prince is the patron of.
The future king allegedly greenlighted the donation after meeting one of the bin Laden brothers in the palatial building known as Clarence House in 2013, only 2 years after U.S. Special Forces killed a 9/11 mastermind in the east of Pakistan.
The prince's office denies any wrongdoing, saying the decision to accept the money was made by the fund's trustees. To those observing the royal family for years, something bigger is at play.
What I think is happening is in Britain at the moment, we're in a transition going from the Elizabethan age, if you will, to a new era in the royal family, which is Prince Charles. And I think what they're doing is cleaning out the closet and getting rid of any skeletons which could shadow or cast a shadow over his accession to the throne.
In February, claims of a cash for honor scandal involving a Saudi businessman, a police investigation into another of Charles's charitable foundations ensued. And before that, reports that between 2011 and 2015, the prince accepted donations totaling $3.2 million to his charity from a former Qatari prime minister, with the cash delivered in shopping bags.
The optics aren't good. And if this money was being received in the Kremlin or in Tehran or another country that's at odds with the West, you can imagine the outcry and the pompous invective that would be spouted towards those countries.
It remains to be seen if the prince will be investigated over this latest revelation. And with an upcoming documentary featuring the life of his deceased former wife, Princess Diana, scrutiny of the 73-year-old royal will intensify. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Under the title Blockade on Yemen, Slow Killing of Civilians under the UN cover, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in Yemen's capital Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemen despite the UN brokered truce.
The United Nations participates directly and indirectly in the killing of the Yemeni people by its silence on the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. Saudi Arabia is violating the terms of the UN armistice, and unfortunately, the international body has not taken any action. And there are falsification of facts and allegations that the Saudi-led coalition cares about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, and this is not true.
Officials say the United Nations is responsible for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen throughout the armistice, as it has failed to force Riyadh to fulfill its obligations under the agreement.
The United Nations is the one who monitors and inspects all ships, including food, medicine, and oil ships, but it does not inspect Saudi ships that carry weapons, and all Yemeni ships are prevented from reaching the Hodeidah port. We believe that the United Nations is responsible for what happens to civilians in Yemen because of its inability to force Riyadh to abide by the terms of the armistice brokered by the international body.
Recently, Yemenis have demonstrated in front of the United Nations Envoy's office in Sana'a to criticize Riyadh's continued detention of Yemeni fuel ships amid the UN brokered truce.
Human rights activists believe the Saudi violations of the UN brokered truce will not stop unless the world body takes real measures against the kingdom. They say the terms of the armistice should be completely fulfilled before any extension. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, is round the corner. Like in other parts of the world, people here in Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority region in India, are also gearing up for annual Muharram ceremonies. Roads and streets are draped with black flags and banners in remembrance of Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his faithful companions who were massacred in the desert plains of Karbala in 680 AD. Painter and calligrapher Shaukat Ahmad is busy these days, preparing banners to be used in mourning rituals. The banners are in huge demand, as they are the integral part of Muharram ceremonies here. The Imam Bargahs, which are congregation halls for Shia commemoration ceremonies, are also being covered with black sheets and banners. The main Muharram commemorations are held in Imam Bargahs, where Kashmiri Marsiyas elegiac poems written to commemorate Imam Hussein and his companions are recited. Also, scholars deliver sermons to highlight the significance of Ashura uprising. Ashura is the 10th day of Muharram when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq 14 centuries ago.
While mourning ceremonies are held in different areas with sizable Shia population, the two major processions in the capital city Srinagar on 8th of Muharram and its 10th day, known as Ashura, were banned in 1990. Despite repeated pleas by religious and political bodies to lift the ban, the authorities remain unmoved.
Muharram processions will be allowed only on the already permitted routes. All those concerned have also been requested to hold processions through those routes only.
The authorities claim the traditional processions in Srinagar pose security threats. The religious bodies and civil activists, on the other hand, term the ban as, quote, blatant breach of religious freedom.
These processions were a symbol of unity, as thousands of Sunnis would participate with Shias in these processions. On the one hand, authorities say that the situation in Kashmir has been back to normal, but on the other hand, they are not allowing such religious processions to take place under the pretext that they would create law and order problems.
The state provides security to Amarnath Yatra that attracts tens of thousands of Hindu pilgrims, and on the other hand, it curbs the historic Muharram processions as well as the celebrations to mark Eid-u-Milad, the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad, in the city center. This speaks volumes about the gross discrimination against the Muslim majority population here.
Every year, despite the clampdown in the region, mourners defy the restrictions and try to carry out the Muharram processions, but they are tear gassed, cane charged and detained. With around 1.5 million population, Shias constitute 10% of the total population of India's only Muslim-majority region, which lies at the heart of more than 70 years of hostility between India and Pakistan. Sedli Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
In a major blow to freedom of the press, the European Union's second highest court has upheld the ban on Russian media outlet RT France for alleged disinformation. Launched in 2017 with a 20 million euro budget and well over 100 employees, RT France burst onto the scene with reporting that the billionaire-dominated French mainstream media refused to touch. Their coverage of the Yellow Vest social revolt won widespread praise. They rejected the total Western media blackout on the movement, which began in June 2019.
Providing news is a public service and an obligation of every state. Therefore, it is entirely legitimate for a state to contribute to the budget of medias so that their citizens have balanced, objective information according to their own point of view.
It was no surprise that President Emmanuel Macron was the first leader to call for a Europe-wide ban on Russian state media. The French government then orchestrated the rapid implementation of the ban less than a week after Russia started its military operation in Ukraine.
It's dramatic when you ban alternative news sources, which haven't even broken any laws. There has been no slander or racism or calls for violence, and yet they're denied freedom of expression. It's a dramatic problem for France and Europe, and compounded by the fact that there is absolutely no alternative point of view permitted or available in French media.
The fact that freedom of the press is granted to far-right media, such as the Islamophobic Charlie Hebdo magazine, but denied to the Russian people, has already left its impression. The citizens of France and Europe have not been allowed to hear both sides of the long-running conflict in Ukraine. This one-sided media domination has allowed European elite to whip up Russophobia and war hysteria unopposed and provided them with the opportunity to impose unprecedented economic and diplomatic pressure on Moscow. Upon relinquishing the EU's rotating presidency in June, Macron was criticized for saying that the unrest in Ukraine accelerated the bloc's collective agenda. The EU was criticized for once again relying on not democratic means to achieve political ends. A final appeal by RT France to the European Court of Justice is expected to fail as well. In 2012, on the orders of the European Commission, Press TV was removed by top European satellite provider Eutelsat. Last year, the PressTV.com domain was seized and shut down by the United States federal government. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organizations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism program. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged. And the government even produced guidance for schools into how, and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by Cage against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalize any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
Imam Hussein in the eyes of Sunni thinkers. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein's personality and movement has astounded every seeker of freedom from any creed. Many scholars and thinkers have spoken on Imam Hussein and the Epic of Ashura during the past 14 centuries. In a few episodes, we are going to dwell upon the words and views of four Sunni thinkers who love Hussein and have expressed their pure love in their works. Stay tuned, please. Abdurrahman al-Sharqawi was an Egyptian thinker, writer, journalist, poet, and dramatist. He was born in 1920 and was graduated in law in 1943. He worked as a lawyer for 2 years and then as an inspector for several years. This contemporary thinker then turned to writing dramas. Al-Sharqawi used to mix his dramas with poems. He wrote a piece on Imam Hussein, peace upon him, which was a brief account of the great epic of Ashura and the events after it. He has tried in the drama to express the political and social realities of his time and to show the way to resist against them. This way he tries to make people understand the value of freedom and dignity. Al-Sharqawi believes that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, does not belong only to Shias, but to the whole mankind. He says, Hussein, peace upon him, is the martyr of religion and freedom. Not only Shias should be proud of him, but all free-spirited people in the world should take pride in his noble name. Al-Sharqawi was very successful in explicating Imam Hussein's personality and movement. He was among the Sunni writers who have conveyed the Imam's message beautifully to the reader. Perhaps one of the most beautiful parts of his dramas is related to the internal conflict of Hur, the commander of
Ibn Ziyad's troops. Al-Sharqawi elaborately depicts Hur's verbal conflict with his senior commander, Umar Sa'd.